Hello, Aaron here. The following is an interview that took place on June 23rd, 2025. I was lucky enough to interview writer, director, star, and producer Rada Blank about the film The 40-Year-Old Virgin, which originally debuted in 2020. It won a directing award at the Sundance Film Festival and premiered on Netflix later that year. The film was screened recently at Vidiots, where filmmaker Robert Townsend was able to interview Rada Blank as well for a Q&A following the screening of the film, but I was lucky enough to speak with Rada for a good amount of time before the film screened. So now, without any further ado, enjoy the interview that I had with star Rada Blank. But I was going to say right now, I don't do interviews often because I don't really have to. So when I do interviews, because I really like the movie.
Oh, wow. What a nice compliment.
I want to throw that out there. Like, it's nice to talk to people, you know, filmmakers and artists and what have you, but like, it's, you know, it can be work. And I'd like to, if I'm going to use that kind of time, I want to do work for people that I actually, like, really admire.
I appreciate that. There's a lot of crap.
I'm sure. I know. I'm a critic. I see a lot of things. I try to find.
I feel for you. Yeah.
But no, I saw this film back in 2020. I saw when it debuted. I didn't get to see it at Sundance, but I saw when it debuted, and I was a huge fan.
Oh, thank you.
Of the work. So I have questions. My first question here. I know, being that it's fairly autobiographical, how does it feel to have this as like a time capsule of sorts?
It's a mix of emotions. There's a moment in the film where my character comes back to her mother's apartment. That is not my mother's apartment, but when I walk in, I'm greeted by my actual brother. Mm-hmm. That's my father's jazz music playing in the background, and that's my mother's artwork on the film. Okay, hold on, sorry. Just trying to keep it together.
Fair enough.
Sorry. What is wrong with me? So in that respect, it definitely is a time capsule because it is capturing my family. Both my parents have passed away. It's capturing us on screen. Mm-hmm. In a moment. There'll never be another film like that. Another thing that I am very happy about is, like, when black people see the film, they say it's black as fuck. Yep. When New Yorkers see the film, they say it's New York as fuck. And listen, that's a huge compliment because New Yorkers don't like shit. They don't like nothing. And, you know, they say they enjoy the film because it feels, even though it's contemporary, it feels nostalgic. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I showed the film at Sundance, I was nervous because I had all of these, like, hip-hop cameos that I wanted to be a surprise for the audience. Most critics didn't know who those MCs were. They're all my favorite New York MCs. So the secret, you know, the cat was not out of the bag. But I think because those rappers are featured, because it's in black and white, because we use a MTA bus from the 90s, you know, and these rappers aren't like the teen du jour rappers of today.
The primo guard, yeah.
You know, it feels like a throwback. Mm-hmm. And that was my intention, is that it feels like a current classic, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what were the biggest challenges making the film?
Being in it.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's
is it hard to be natural, like, while also direct, knowing that you're consciously trying to direct?
Yes. Clark Johnson, mm-hmm, who you may know from Homicide, Life on
Clark
the Street.
Johnson, yeah.
He's become, like, such a huge advocate and gave me the best advice. He said, do me a favor, when you're in a scene with your scene partner, let the director go. I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah, let the director go. He said, otherwise, they're going to be saying lines to you and you're going to be looking in their mouth like, is that how I want them to? He said, just let it go and be a good scene partner. And so that was really good. But I'm not going to lie, it was grueling work. Mm-hmm. And then there was a moment when, you know, the scene where I have like the tuxedo and I'm at the premiere of my play. I was at the bar at the Signature Theater. We were shooting a scene where I'm listening to my terrible play being performed. And I said, cut. And all of a sudden, the sound person comes to fix my mic. The wardrobe person comes to fix my wardrobe. Makeup comes. My DP comes. Mm-hmm. And there are all these people on me. And I was just like, I don't like the
things. It was overwhelming, yeah.
So there were just different things that made it challenging. I probably won't be featured in another one of my films. There is a role that I do want to play in one of my films, but it's a very, very small part. But other than that, I don't. It was gruesome. So yeah.
Gruesome.
Gruesome. It was hard. I mean, it paid off.
Sure.
You know, and I was being very strategic because I was like, first of all, I can't play 39 forever. So I had to make that film first. Uh-huh. But also, I was like, oh, yeah, like when you see somebody in something, it may be kind of serious them in your mind. And I wouldn't say it made it easier to make a new project because it was a struggle over the last 5 years, but I was more familiar to people in the industry. And every once in a while, I would get recognized on the street, especially if I was with Peter Kim, who played my best friend. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, people would be staring at me like, does that bitch owe me money? You know? And I'm like, One time I was in a movie theater and in New York, and because of the spikes of COVID, crime was like the 80s. Mm-hmm. And so you never knew like what was gonna go down, yeah. You know, and New Yorkers, we always have like that whole, yeah, I wish someone would come on, you know. So I had just seen a movie and I'm in the bathroom washing my hands, and I'm not lying, this lady was approaching me like in slow motion, and I had my handbag, and I was like, I'm gonna have to knock this bitch out because she's about to attack. It felt like she was gonna attack me, but really she was moving in to be like, are you the lady from? And I was like, yes, I am. Nice to meet you. Hold on. And I had to catch my breath because I thought she was running up on me. So, you know, that stuff has kind of died down. But I remember seeing the billboard of the film at Lenox on 125th Street. It is a black woman, a black looking woman with a head wrap and door knocker earrings on. And I was just like, holy shit. Like, that shocked me. And that was kind of a surprise because I kind of led the marketing campaign. I was like, oh, we should use these kind of signifiers of either hip hop or black culture. And one time they surprised me with that poster, and I was like, what the, you know, it's a still from the movie. It wasn't even a photograph I posed for. So it was like, first I was embarrassed. I was like, I don't want to be on a poster. But then I was like, nah, this is a big deal. Like, some little girl's going to see that and be like, mommy, look, that's me.
It's a striking image. It's evocative about, you know, it doesn't reveal to be beyond just this.
And right. It works. And it says it's setting up the film. Yes. It's black and white, you know, and that was an exciting time. I can't even lie. Like,
for sure.
Getting to engage Netflix on, like, how do we build out the marketing? And again, this is in the throes of COVID. So it's like, how do we... engage people, like, what kind of trailer will we make? And I got to be a part of all of those conversations. So I'm spoiled at this point.
Was it always going to be black and white?
Always.
Yeah.
Always, always, always. And I've had a number of confrontations with different people about it, especially before we made the film, and I was trying to engage financiers. And I remember I was at Catalyst, which is a pitching forum that Sundance does, and you get to, as filmmakers, you get selected to go there and meet potential financiers. Mm-hmm. I met a lot of people who were like, oh, we love this, but black and white, like, nobody makes a black and white film. And Sundance, they always show a film, you know, we have a film night where we watch something that, you know, it was probably going to premiere soon, and we have conversations, and it was Roma, a black and white film. So what I did was, after the screening, I waited outside the screening, and I looked at all the financiers who were considering. I said, how was that black and white film? Did you enjoy that black and white film shot on film with a person in the lead who you don't know at all? How was that? Okay, great. You know, because it's all very possible. It's just about finding... What is it that Gaga used to say? There could be 99 people in a room, and it's just that one person. And it's true. It's just that one person.
So that's the vision.
Yeah, and Lena Waite was my person. Mm-hmm. She believed in me. And so, yeah, it was a fortunate turn of events.
Was the title always going to be the title?
Always.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine was like, why would you do that? Like, it's too close to 40-year-old virgin. And I was like, well, that's what I want. Is I wanted to pop up, you know, when that guide, the virtual guide on the TV Guide channel, whatever, has the things. Someone's going to think it's 40-year-old virgin, and they're going to click on the virgin. And
so intentional misdirect was your plan.
It wasn't intentional misdirect, but I decided, like... all the way up until we started our marketing campaign, it was 40-year-old version. And I was like, oh, no, let's spell it out. Now, something very interesting happened is fans of the 40-year-old virgin, I will let you guess what the cross section of race and gender is around that, came for me. Like, okay. Who is this girl trying to, like, scoop our dude, you know? Mm-hmm. Yes, I was very openly appropriating his title and his running time. I was like, this man can make a 2-hour comedy, so can I. And the moment that really, like, made me go, all right, is Judd Apatow on Twitter serving their asses. He's like, I don't know about y'all, but I fucking love her movie. Leave her alone and watch it. And then come back to me. And I was just like, yeah. Come on, white male ally. That's what I'm fucking talking about.
I have a vague memory of this.
I reposted that shit. I was like, oh my God. Because 40-year-old version for me is, you know, knocked up and 40-year-old virgin. Like, I wanted to make a comedy about someone who's bumbling through life. Mm-hmm. She just happens to be black and female.
Yeah.
You know, and so it is a send-up of his films. And we've actually had the pleasure of being on a panel together, and he's a really cool person, honestly. And I've even gotten to pitch on different projects that he's developing, but it was a moment, you know, us kind of bonding over the title.
What was it like to go from premiering at Sundance to getting picked up by Netflix?
It was amazing. My producers and sales agent had to kind of reel me back because Sundance was such a fucking party. And who knew that was the super spreader? That was the COVID super spreader. Yeah, because people were coming from all over the world and people were coming down with little colds.
And it's still
sniffles.
Early. It was still early.
Right.
So
it was January, end of January going into February. And then people were kind of like, we call it like coming off of the hill of the mountain. And people coming down the mountain like, yeah, I'm going back to New York. But excuse me, I had such a good time. And it was like, everyone in hindsight is like, that was a super spreader. But Sundance, I've gone a number of times. This is my first time going as a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. Like, it's such a party. And you're at the screenings, and what a privilege to get to see where your film works and where it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Like, if there's lulls and laughter, people are shifting around. Like, I'm sitting back there taking notes, but also just enjoying the crowd. And I was talking about the Salt Lake City screenings, like, every filmmaker needs to go to Salt Lake screenings because it's not really industry. Mm-hmm. It's senior, elderly, you know, all kinds of queer folks, activists, you know, liberal Jews. Everybody's at the screening and they're not industry. So they're laughing like they all took a hit of coke. I'm like, nothing is this fucking funny. And they're in there slapping their knees. And what I realize is that Sundance, they're laughing, they're having a good time, but they're a little subdued. You know, they're agents, they're buying shit, they're distributors.
I know how that goes. Yeah.
Salt Lake was the shit. And my producers had to reel me back in like, hey, we're trying to sell this movie. You got to go to every screening? I was like, yeah, I got to be with the audience. And I'm glad I did because COVID changed everything after that. So that was my first time, even though that wasn't the final cut of the film, that was my first time and kind of most important moment with its audience. But it was such a damn good time. I almost forgot that it was a market.
Yeah.
And I had to go out and have these clandestine meetings with these different, you know, studios in the middle of the night in the snow and all sort of shit. I mean, that's what the Netflix meeting was like. And I'm going to be real with you. I almost ruined that shit.
Okay.
I can say it now. But at the time, their marketing team, their awards campaign team, everybody's like brilliant. But they led with the conversation about awards. And, you know, I'm like the child of Kathleen Collins and Robert Townsend, like, and I ain't talking about no damn awards. And Netflix was like, who is she talking to? And all my producers was like, Rodney Dangerfield, like, she gonna fuck it up for us. I was like, I'm a filmmaker, damn it, and I don't want to talk about no awards. That's about confining it. And they were looking at me, and I literally had to, it was Lisa Nishimura, who was the development person at the time. She's no longer at Netflix, but I had to kind of call her up, and I was in the snow at like 2 a.m. saying, hey, Lisa, I was a little over and passionate about the filmmaking. I still hope we can have a conversation about possibly distributing the film. And it was good. I was very fortunate that they were still open because quite as it kept there was not a bidding war for that film. People like, oh my God, everybody wants to distribute. And that's not true. And for those who did, the bids were so low. Mm-hmm. Like, I know it looks like a scrappy film, but it cost us almost $4 million to make, you know? And that's because...
I think it's a good-looking film, by the way.
Thank you. And but I'm not surprised that you might say that, but most people are like, what? I thought it was $1 million. No. I have the music. It's music.
Yes.
I have to clear the music. Yeah. That Quincy Jones clip alone, thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. And people are like, and you're going to use it twice? Oh, my God, Ronald, why? You know, but I just wanted to make the film in a certain way. I'm a New Yorker. Born and raised. Mm-hmm. I know when you're not shooting in New York. Mm-hmm. Don't sell me this bullshit. This is on a lot. And it's not even in New York. It's in Toronto, bitch. So when it says exterior Brownsville, Brooklyn Day, my producers are like, okay, what are you going to shoot for Brownsville? I said Brownsville. And anybody who knows Brownsville, it's not a walk in the park. It's a little rough. But I've been in the audience of a film that's supposed to take place in New York, and I immediately taken out of storytelling when I'm like, why are there only 10 people on the street? So background casting, music, locations, processing that film, you know, it took a lot more than people understood. But it's, you know, the fact that people can still find it on Netflix and probably for the next 12 years, it'll be there. I made out like a bandit, so.
I was going to ask, how did you feel about the eventual release? I know, you know, it's great. You got picked up. You got the movie distributed. That's wonderful. Obviously, Netflix has a lot of stuff that they put out there, so things could get lost sometimes depending on how things go.
I was concerned about that, very concerned about it. The first thing that made me say, I need to think about this, I really was trying to be like an auteur. Mm-hmm. You know, like making just films that come from my genius and my IP and all this other stuff. And the idea of being on a streaming platform in the beginning felt cheap to me. I was like, this is not about cinema, you know. But it was Lena Waithe, my producer, executive producer at the time, who was like, yeah, but you have family in Trinidad, you have family in the South. There's no coffee house cinema there. How are they going to see it? So it made sense that it would be on streaming. Also, one of the biggest compliments I've gotten on a film is when someone says, I've watched your film 5 times. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what? I know that wouldn't happen if we had a typical distribution deal. But what was important to me was my financiers getting their money back. Yeah. I just could not move forward knowing like, we doing this thing with this very serious, you know, cinema platform, but my financiers didn't get paid. And what a lot of people don't know about Lena, maybe they do, but I know it personally how generous she is. We were running out of money, and first rule of producing is don't put your own money in that shit. She did. She put a lot of money in, and so it was very important to me that I was able to pay her back, and Netflix allowed me to do that.
That's great. In terms of what the film speaks to when it comes to black artists and their stories, do you think anything has changed in the 5 years since this film was good? No. I feel like I answered that question already.
No.
I felt like that was going to be the answer.
No. And, you know, it's so special to me that Robert would make himself available for our talk tonight. We did one similar when I showed the movie at the Paris Theater. And the reason that was a big deal in 2022 or 23 was COVID. We were calling it the Omarion strain, but I think it was the, not Omega, I don't even know what the name is. We were calling it Omarion.
I blocked a lot of that.
Yeah, I did too. But I got to show the film, mm-hmm. on the reels. I took pictures of me and the projectionist who'd been there for 1 million years. And in showing the film there, which was the first time I got to show it in New York, because by the time it came out on Netflix, New York theaters were not open. Mm-hmm. And though Netflix gave me this beautiful drive-in, it's not the same. Because you're sitting in a car, can't hear people laughing, so you're kind of watching the movie on a TV, really, mm-hmm. from a car. But I got to show it in New York and got to show 9 films that influenced me. So it was everything from Cassavetes Shadows, Tap, Hollywood Shuffle. Mm-hmm. And Robert came into town and we did an amazing talk back. Now we get to talk after the screening of my film. And, you know, his film was made 88.
Yeah.
And the conversation about gatekeepers is still very prevalent. Mm-hmm. And I think because of the strikes and because of COVID, the industry right now is more risk averse than ever. Mm-hmm. I think people think, oh, well, you have film that was won Best Director. Surely you have an advantage. I have some advantage. Mm-hmm. I find that my white male counterparts can still make films a lot faster than I can, even with an award-winning film. Mm-hmm. You'd think that would make, you know, so, yeah, no, I think because of these things that have happened and now we're in the time of anti-DEI and people are showing their asses, I just feel like it's more risk averse than it's been in a long time. So for people on the margins, black, queer, of color, it's just going to be tough. It's just going to be tough. And I don't know when it'll let up. I really don't.
I was going to ask, do you think it's any harder to make a film like this today than it would be?
Well, here's what I'll say. Mm-hmm. One trend that I feel has come back is the, what I would call the slasher filmmaker, the person making the film is writing it, directing it, producing and starring in it. I've seen that happen more often. More people are shooting on film, as opposed to digital, but digital is now looking more like film.
Sure.
So if that's your preference, and you have, I think, in 5 years that have passed, it just is a better format. So people can shoot things that look like film, but I'm sure that if someone wanted to write, direct, produce, and star in their own film today, and they were a woman of color, they have a better chance of shooting it themselves on an iPhone. Or the other option would be, if they didn't have angel producers, financiers like I did, mm-hmm. they'd have to do stunt casting and get a star, which is what people were convincing me to do to mm-hmm. make the film, because, oh, you know, black and white, 35mm film, nobody knows who the hell you are. But I'm just like, that is the charm of my film, is it feels, mm-hmm. you know,
it's authenticity
urgent.
There.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What are you working on now?
Well, I wish I could actually say it. I can't. I probably got like 2 weeks until it's announced, but it's a remake.
Okay.
Of a film that had two very big stars in it, but we're changing that, and a comedy that I'm writing and directing with a major studio, mm-hmm. Which I did not feel was my trajectory. I really thought I'd be on more of a Ari Aster Softy Brothers track.
Okay.
Like just kind of making things with a very specific voice. Mm-hmm. But I realized like the filmmakers I'm looking at now are people like Penny Marshall, mm-hmm. who didn't necessarily write everything that she directed, but she definitely elevated it.
Put their stamp on it.
Right. And I look at a film like A League of Their Own and I'm just like, that is a classic film. Mm-hmm. Everybody's in that shit.
Yeah.
And they made a spinoff on TV. Like, her career, I realized like, oh, I'm not so focused on being an auteur. I want to focus on being a great director. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to write everything. But because I come to the industry as a writer first, I'm always going to have a pass just so I can smooth the edges of the language where it fits with, you know, what I'm saying visually. But yeah, quite a journey.
Is there any future for Rodimus Prime?
Yeah, I mean, 50-year-old version, 60-year-old version.
That's my next question.
You know, maybe
we missed 45, but maybe 50.
Yeah,
or
maybe I can get Depends as like a sponsor and shit. You know, and I could do a song called "Peeing in My Diaper" because I'm always talking about wearing a diaper. You know, people are like, oh, we're gonna take a bathroom break. I'm like, ah, nope, wearing a diaper, I'm good. Yeah, if I can, you know, at one point I was pitching something to HBO as like a a one-off comedy thing with Rodimus Prime, because I've done that live show, mm-hmm. which you see at the end of the film is an actual Rodimus Prime show. I love performing. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm not so interested in being in any more of my films is I really enjoy directing actors and I want to do that. But how am I going to get my performance thing off? It's why I kind of admire the Safdie brothers is I want to be in more things and things that I'm not, you know, that I didn't write or create. But that Rodimus Prime platform is a gem of catharsis. I get to kind of, you know, talk about things. And I'm not the person who's like, well, I need to do a show. I only want to do performance when there's something I really have to say that I can't say anywhere else. So, yes, Rodimus is still alive.
And that's why I was curious what you're working on, because I try to do my research, see what you've been up to since then. But, like, film-wise, it's limited. But I don't know if there's still performances, you know, live show-wise or theater or whatever.
No performances right now. It's been a very insular, isolated, quiet experience. And mm-hmm. I've been kind of like this because I hadn't been on set in so long. But I was doing a lot of development. I was developing a show with FX for 3.5 years mm-hmm. that recently got the axe. Mm-hmm. I was developing another show with Gina Bythewood and Reggie Bythewood and Issa Rae over a year, and that got the axe. I mean, we're talking about big fucking names,
yeah.
and they're getting the axe. So when I say that the business is risk-averse for these stars,
uh-huh.
what?
Yeah, the Bythewoods? Oh, boy. And
they've sold, yeah, and they've not only sold shows, but both the Bythewoods had Swagger canceled.
Mm-hmm.
And he said,
"I like Swagger a lot too."
And I'm going to tell Reggie that. That's my bro. Mm-hmm. And then Issa Rae had Rap Shit canceled,
which I also liked.
It was getting so good.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, oh, black shows, 2 seasons and we're out, you know. And so
That authenticity there too, as far as just the culture.
What I appreciate about both of their separate factions is like they're so invested in like writing. So yeah, I mean, that's where I've been. And there are a couple people on Twitter who are like, what happened to Rada Blank? Is she still alive? God, did she go get that farm that she's been threatening to do? Is she a social worker? She made all these complaints about the industry and said, I'm going to be a social worker. And I always say, because I'm not, I probably save more kids by not being a social worker. But yeah, there are people on there like, where the fuck is Rada Blank? It's a shame with the industry dead to her. You know, and they don't know that I'm behind the scenes, like trying to get a show off the ground or get my film or blah, blah, blah. And yeah, I'm a typical Libra. You know, it's either a drought or a tsunami. And I'm kind of in the tsunami phase in that I've secured 2 projects. One of the projects I kind of can't believe the star power attached to it. And it's 2 young men. And the producers did not think my gender was an obstacle to telling the story.
Good.
And that made me feel good. I was like, okay, there are some cool fucking dudes in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what this year has been about, is finding, and I've prayed for the, I'm not religious, but I do have conversations with my ancestors as the movie reflected, but I really said, I need to find people who get my voice. If I don't find those people, then I will be quitting the business, because it doesn't make sense to me. Even if people say, oh, you got this great film, you're so talented, blah, blah. It means nothing if you can't
mm-hmm.
get the support and the resources. Camille Billups, she was a film artist. Her and her husband, she's a black woman. She's married to a Jewish man whose name was, I want to say Arthur Hatch. And there's the Hatch Billups collection of all of their archival films that they've made. She's this hippy-dippy artist who wears like black coat. She passed away. Big hat. One of my mother's artist friends. So she's like an auntie to me. And I remember I'd won a small grant for a film, a short film I had written. And she's, again, dippy. She smells like patchouli. She comes in like Mother Earth. And we're all sitting there like, Miss Camille, what is it that we, what do we need to make these films? And she's just like, money. If you don't have money, you can't fucking make film. And we all were like, oh, we thought she was going to say some like esoteric. No. And I think from that age, I was like 20. I got so intimidated. And I got so fucking intimidated. But, you know, now I actually feel like you know, because I was clear, it's like, I know I have the talent, I know I have the taste. There's a difference between taste and talent. Mm. Some people don't have both. But I know I have the talent, I know I have the taste, I just don't have my army. I don't have my arsenal. And because I started focusing on, like, finding those people, they've appeared to me, my manager is this young brother from Detroit, Justin Browning, Corporate Browning. I fucking love him. He gets me. We speak the same language. He's the person who brought these two projects to me. That if someone else would have said, oh, I think you should look at this remake and blah, blah, blah. Initially, I was like, fuck this shit. I don't do that. I'm an auteur. But something about the way he translated it to me and the fact that he had a certain level of taste to bring that to me. Then the producer I'm working with on this remake, an amazing person. He's just as stuck up as I am about films. He's a cinephile. And sometimes I'll go see something and I'm like, did you see something? He's like, yeah, what a fucking stinker. This is who I get to make a movie with. We have the same stuck up, snooty attitude. And so I think I'm moving into a season of harvest. Mm-hmm. You know, that I, 5 years ago, I did not think things would happen in this way. I was just very limited in how I wanted to make films. And now what I realize is that talent, that taste, that drive means nothing in this industry if you don't have the champions, you know. And so I found two or three really great people who I really feel like I prayed for. And now I feel like I get to have a career. I gotta stay in shape because, you know, this new project with the two young strapping stars, like, I go on IG and these motherfuckers, excuse my friend, they're in the gym every damn day. I said, you're not gonna show my ass up. I'm gonna lose some weight and I'm gonna have my breath back. I'm not gonna pass out on set. You ain't gonna have me look like some old bitch. Now pass me that burger before it gets cold. No, but I see them, they're getting in shape. I said, okay, no. Like I said, with that particular project, it's a team of men. And I was shocked that they not only loved my pitch, they were like, look, I'm just keeping it real with you. They were like, if the stars have a problem with you being that director, we'll find other stars. These are big time dudes. You'll see when the film is announced. But I was like, wow, they believe in me. They didn't see my gender. They didn't see breasts and a vagina. They were like, this person's from New York. She don't fucking play. And that's our director. So it has kind of fortified me in a way. Like, I just stand a little bit taller. And I can't wait to be on set because I realize that that's a big part of who I am. And if I'm not on set, then I'm kind of not myself. So it's a blessing in this day and age with all the anti-DEI shit and, you know, having a fucking living Cheeto in the fucking White House. I this is a satire that just... Did you see The Apprentice?
Yeah.
What'd you think of it?
It was... I could admire the performances, but it's like, what am I getting out of this?
Well, Bevy Smith is a author. She comes from fashion. She's an influencer. She mm-hmm. was in the audience. She was so mad because she was like, are they trying to make us fucking empathize with this asshole?
Yeah.
I thought it was really good. And I learned a lot about the influence of Roy Cohn on him, which I think a lot of people don't know about. Mm-hmm. Like, when Roy Cohn is saying, like, I don't care what they accuse you, deny everything. You're like, that is Trump. That's exactly who he is. This is one of those moments where it's like, wow, film is this really fucking powerful tool. Like, I know people are really mad at that film.
I think years from now, it'll play better. I think in the moment, if you're constantly, and I try not to be constantly tapped into what's going on.
I was on a plane the other day with a man who doesn't watch the news. He had no idea that we bombed Iran. And I was like, damn, sorry. He was like, yeah, I don't watch the news. This shit is depressing. I said, oh, sorry.
I was at a party on Saturday night. And I was like, this is a great time. Turn on my phone. Oh.
Every alert. Right. And then the next day, I have to fly out. So I turn into the worst New Yorker ever. I'm just like, oh my God, who's going to blow us up and stuff? But anyway, there was something that happens in The Apprentice that I didn't know was in Ivana Trump's book.
Okay.
You know what I'm talking about?
No.
When he attacked her. Yeah, I don't want to spoil it for you guys, but... Yeah, I was like, what the fuck? And my friend was like, yeah, no, she said that he raped her. Mm-hmm. And I was like, and people are going to see this movie and still support this.
Yeah.
So film, for me, as a person who is a little clunky and maybe not as articulate as I'd like to be as an activist, it does create this opportunity where I can start this, have this conversation and get people talking or thinking about things, you know, laughing at some very unfunny things just so you can actually have the conversation about that thing that's not really funny. So I feel very privileged. I've made my complaints. Again, I threatened to leave the business and go into farming. But there are probably some llamas and sheep who are like, oh, fucking thank God. Can you imagine if we had to be on herb farm? God dang, we'd be skinny and shit. So yeah, I'm blessed. And, you know, so Robert is coming tonight. I just found out Charles Burnett is supposed to be coming tonight.
Oh, wow.
And I'm just like, God, I'm a fucking lucky rabbit, man. I really am. Like, but these are the people who want to show up for the film or the conversation, you know, so.
I have one last question.
Sure.
You won the directing award at Sundance. Mm-hmm. You're the second black woman to do so.
Come on, Sundance.
What, if there's one piece of advice you'd give to other filmmakers trying to do something similar, you know, just try to get in and somehow try to make their film, what would it be?
Fellowship. Mm. You have to build your community. You know, like other black filmmakers. I remember I was at Sundance and I didn't know. Netflix, you know, was buzzed that they wanted to possibly, you know, buy the film, and I wasn't sure. And Khalil Joseph, are you familiar with him? You should. He's fucking dynamic. He's more of an avant-garde filmmaker. Beautiful black and white work he's done around black cowboys and stuff like that. And
what are some of his films?
Huh?
What are some of his films?
That's a good question. I can't name a film.
I'll look it up.
But they're shorts and they're experimental.
They're shorts, okay.
And he did Black News.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was at Sundance last year, I think.
Yeah, it sounds, yeah.
But, you know, I'm thinking of him as this really, like, artiste. I've had friends in the industry who's like, I'm trying to work with Khalil Joseph, but he doesn't seem to want my money. And I was like, you know, you gotta let some people be artists. Like, everybody's not like, oh, sure, I'll do the version of the film that you want me to make and compromise my vision and stuff. So I'm always thinking of him as a pure artist. And when it was this idea of like going to Netflix, I was like, oh, but then I don't get to be an auteur showing my film in an art house cinema, you know. And he was like, do that shit. He was like, raise the vibration of the platform by having your film on there. And someone's going to watch something in black and white or something with New York and something with, you know, a black woman in the lead, and your film's going to be an algorithm. One time, my film was right next to Beyonce's Homecoming. And I was like, how the fuck did that happen? You know, and then you look at the cover of her film, and it's her in black and white.
Yep.
And then it's me in black and white. And I had to take a snapshot of that. But it was Khalil Joseph, the, like, pure artistic cinematic voice telling me, yeah, go on the platform. And more, you cultivate an audience, people have a place to find it. I would not have felt confident about making that decision if he wasn't a part of my community. So people like him and Dee Reese, who, if I'm just being honest, when I won the award, I actually thought we would win ensemble, or we would at least get close to it because we were nominated. Mm-hmm. And then once we didn't, I went and got drunk. In fact, people put some THC in my drink. I was fucked up. And I was sitting in the audience, out of my mind, and I'm looking on stage, and Dee Reese, my friend, is up there. And she's like, and the winner of this award is a talented acting, directing, writing, rapping. And I said, oh, someone else is rapping in their movie. That's so cool. I saw this other rapper in the movie. She said, Rod Blank. I was like, huh? And I had to go up there drunk, and I was like, I started ugly crying, and I got up to the thing, and I was like, I was looking at Dee, I was like, and she was like, she knew the whole time, and I'd seen her, we'd been partying together and all this shit, and she knew the whole time. I was like, you bitch. And the mic picked up, you know. But like, that's my family, and I would not be able to make it if I wasn't able to call on her, call on Coleman Domingo, call on Terrence. Like, these are people who've just, like, held my back. You know, I mean, the ancestors can't be there. There are these people who are holding your back so you can kind of face it. Because The other thing I have to tell a filmmaker who wants to do this, it's not for the faint of heart. It's not. You know, I've quit the business 242 times. I don't know, but like, it can make you doubt your dreams, you know, but when you have that fellowship who can be a mirror to you and say, I see you, you know, Clark Johnson was one of several mentors who had looked at my film on a small screen and they were like, why is she this far across the room? And why is this? And why? I don't understand. And he didn't say anything the whole time while the mentors, the advisors are looking at it. And then we left the trailer and we're standing outside. He was like, you got this, sis. I see you. And then we showed the screening on the big screen. And all those people who were like, why did this? And why did it? They were like, oh, she did know what she was doing. So to me, it's like, developing that fellowship, connecting with people who see you and who you see them, that you can't survive without that. Yeah.
This has been great. Thank you so much for your time.
Yes, so nice meeting you.
Yeah, for
Thanks
sure.
for the great questions.
I will say I had to resist watching the movie because I wanted to see it here. So
is this your first time seeing it on a big screen?
On a big screen, yes.
Oh,
so
wow.
I was excited for sure, and I'm looking forward to, you know, seeing Robert as well.
Robert, Charles Burnett is going to be here. Prince is coming back from the dead. we're going to do a seance, get Michael Jackson in there. But, you know, we'll see what we can do. Maybe Tina Turner show. I don't know. But, you know, we're going to have fun. And I'm just really grateful to Vidiots for doing this because it's, you know, I don't know when we'll get to see it on the big screen again. So.
For sure. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
My thanks once again to Radha Blank for spending as much time as she did answering my questions, and to Vidiots for allowing me to speak to Radha to begin with. Be sure to check out the 40-year-old version. It's currently available on Netflix, and it's quite a good film. And be sure to look out for whatever Radha Blank does next. I certainly will be. Out now, Fair and Abe can be found anywhere you can find podcasts, so feel free to check us out in all of our other episodes as well. And yeah, until next time, so long and goodbye.